Welcome to the Property Nomads podcast. Today's guest is calling in from Barbados, so very exotic. We are getting out and about there around the world. And this is definitely an episode that you want to listen to, the seven deadly sins of construction. So today's guest has been involved in various projects for over 40 years, has dealt with over $5.5 billion worth of capital projects, over $200 million in construction projects, annual turnover of just under $1 billion, 40 years experience. Ian Rogers, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. Nice to be on your podcast. Real pleasure.
Yeah, really looking forward to this. And just for people listening, the angle that we're taking with this episode, Ian, you've has obviously got a wealth of knowledge to bring to not just yourself, listener, to myself as well. I'll chip in with probably some rookie questions here and there. And the reason I say that is the level of depth that Ian's going to go into about construction. You know, I'm at the time of recording, I hold my hands up. I can't claim to have done construction projects. So I'm not able to speak from experience. This is the purpose of getting someone like Ian on who has, you know, done millions and millions and millions of, you know, dollars worth of projects. All of that being said, Ian, before we deep dive into the seven deadly sins of construction, which I'm going to try not to say too often with a list, because I'm digging my own grave if I keep doing that, give us a bit more about your background and how you've remained in the industry for such a magnificent period of time.
Sure. Yeah, no problem, Rob. Well, I was pretty well born into construction, actually. My father had a small building firm in the town that we lived, about 30, 40 professionals and tradespeople. So from a very young age, probably 11, 12 years of age, I was on construction sites labouring and seeing what was going on with, in those days, true tradespeople. Couldn't do that these days, of course, with all the health and safety. But I just grew up with, around construction and in construction and seeing what was going on. So it became inevitable that I went into the industry. I qualified as a chartered quantity surveyor originally, went into mainstream contracting rather than the professional QS office, and worked on a number of different projects from colleges to swimming pools to offices to what have you. And then I moved across to facilities management, which was a whole new ball game for me. But in reality, it's the same sort of issue, contractually looking at the contracts and valuing work and all that sort of thing. But it's very much more into relationships rather than the traditional construction contractor being a one-off, inevitably with disputes and arguments and everything else. And then from there, I started getting involved with the ubiquitous project finance initiative in the UK. Whether you love it or hate it, it had its place at the time for building infrastructure that the government at the time couldn't afford and was misaligned because it's of its complexity. It wasn't fully understood by the general public and the press and everything. And as a result, it got quite a bad rap, in my opinion. But what that allowed me to do is to bring my construction and my operational experience together into a project to look at what's called the whole life cycle of a project. Because these big PFI projects, they take on the whole risk for the conception period of 25 to 40 years. So the company running that project is responsible for maintenance, initially construction, financing it, designing it, the whole thing, as well as then maintaining it and looking after the building to the best quality that is prescribed in the contract. And then doing all the capital replacement of boilers and air conditioning and all of that sort of thing through the life of the concession period. So therefore, you have to look at the whole design at the beginning to make sure you've got the best fit right at the very beginning for the optimization of the whole life cycle cost. So that's where I'm at now with doing my own consultancy business. I'm looking at helping clients with their projects and their construction by understanding what the end game is at the beginning.
Wonderful stuff. And I'm sure you're going to touch upon that in these seven deadly sins. To cover another base, I'm sure people might be listening thinking, well, we've mentioned Barbados, but you don't necessarily have that Caribbean twang. So how, if you don't mind elaborating briefly, how have you ended up in Barbados?
Thanks, Rob. An interesting story, and not was on my plan originally, but I was working in the UK. I was working for big corporates, and then in 2008, I set up on my own to do some property investing, which was not the best time in 2008, and then started doing some consultancy work. Was reasonably successful in working in that arena, and then picked up a small piece of work in Barbados to help structure a PFI PPP project out here for a contractor. We were so successful in that small assignment that we got them to preferred bidder. They asked us to then structure the whole deal, which is what we did. The government then announced and noticed us and threw all sorts of projects, including a sugar factory at us. And I've been here ever since. And that was, well, initially started in 2011, and I've been here permanently since 2013, and absolutely loving it, as you can imagine. But I also do work internationally across the Caribbean and back in the UK, and I'm looking now at a big project in the Philippines. So I've now started to work truly internationally from the base in Barbados.
Love modern technology as well, that's enabled that. Okay, cool. So thank you for sharing your backstory then and how you've ended up in Barbados. So again, let's go into these seven deadly sins of construction then. We were speaking off air. These are in no particular order. And the first one on the list that you've put down are excessive change orders. So what is an excessive change order and why is that imperative?
Right. Well, let me reel back before that. I'll come back to that particular point. I'll just make a couple of interesting points and observations. When I've done some research recently, I found that on average, 80% of construction projects fail. And why I'm concentrating on construction projects is this is important to developers, particularly newbie developers into the marketplace, whatever the size. Yes, I've worked on a lot of big projects, but this applies equally to small projects, converting houses, developing HMOs, or whatever you want to consider. The same principles apply, whether it's a massive, great big project or a small project. And as I say, 80% fail through cost overruns, delays, disputes, quality issues, and all that sort of thing. So, and we'll back to this later on, but the essential point is to start at the beginning with a real emphasis on how you start that project and how it's defined properly. And maybe we can cover that off at the end to summarize where we've been. But when you come back to excessive change orders, what this means is variations or extras or changes in the type of work that's being done, all because it hasn't been thought through properly at the very beginning. Yes, you are going to have changes, particularly if you're refurbishing an existing building and or a new project in the ground, because there are unknowns. That is the nature of a construction project. But you should know roughly what's going on, so therefore you can put in contingencies around the unknown elements. When you're opening up an old building, you never know quite what you can find there in terms of dry rot, subsidence, or what have you. But if you've done the right surveys at the beginning, you can plan from as much of that as possible. So what happens here is the developer usually hands over, and this is not knocking architects or the design team, hands over to the architect. They put a brief together and design, but they're not necessarily understanding what's needed at the beginning, particularly in terms of what the client really wants out of that building, in terms of the returns, why they're doing it, all of that sort of thing. And things are often left out. And it's only as you go along that the client says, oh, actually, I need a storeroom here. Oh, this should be happening here. Oh, how are we going to get access to maintain the boiler? All of these things. And they end up being change orders or variations. As I said, some will be unknowns. And if you've got a contingency pot there ready to go, you can draw on that contingency pot for the unexpected. But some of the stuff I've just mentioned really should have been in the plan from day one. And if that hasn't been thought through properly, then that's going to add extra cost onto the project and push you potentially over budget, which has all sorts of other implications that you've drawn or may have funding for a certain size project, and suddenly it's 10, 15, 20% more money. Whereas if you thought this through at the beginning, could have come up with other solutions or set the right budget for your drawdown of your financing at the beginning, so you've got a more robust solution. So excessive change orders, in my opinion, start to come primarily from not thinking the project through from the very, very beginning, before the design team is even appointed.
Just on excessive change orders, let me completely rephrase that. Just on contingency, if someone was thinking of doing a commercial conversion, whatever it might be, is there, for your years of experience, is there a, ballpark contingency that you would say to people, this is roughly what you should put aside just in case? Is there a rough percentage that you think's feasible?
There are some guideline percentages, and it all depends how robust you are in briefing the design team and knowing what's going on. So if you're very, very confident in your projections and your briefing and design, you can go as probably low as 2.5% of the capital cost. But if it's more loose and you really don't know what's going on, particularly if it's a very old, say, Victorian building, you might want to put in 10 or even 15% contingency figures. So it's driven by how robust you are with the briefing and design in the first place.
I'm just making notes, briefing. Okay, so that's excessive change orders. If we're able to move on to point two, you've put down scope creep. Which again, I'll hold my hands up, it's a bit over my head. So if you can expand on that and give some examples, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, scope creep comes back to the initial brief you put together. So let's take a new building, because that's the easiest thing. So I want a warehouse of 5,000 square feet with 6 offices in it. And a brief is put together, the design is done, they start to go through and they realize that the size of the building is not big enough. So therefore, they need to add another 20 or 30% to the warehouse because they hadn't thought about the finishing process that's going to be in this warehouse or what have you. Or they realize that 4 offices is not big enough now that the company has grown and they need 10 offices. So suddenly you get a whole increased building, if you like. Or you could say, right, well, I've got 4 houses on this site. Actually, I can squeeze 5 or 6 houses on this site. So it increases the whole scope of the project. Or originally, your design and identity is you're going to build the building on a shell and core activity, i.e. the basic structure, not finished, because it was going to be the tenant that was going to fit it out. Now you've realized that the market has changed and you can't let shell and core buildings and you've got to finish it. So therefore, that adds a significant amount of work and change of emphasis on what the project is about. So it could be a whole host of different things, but it's effectively adding a significant extra element to the project that you hadn't anticipated in the beginning. So it sort of links with the first item we talked about in terms of variation orders, because inevitably variation orders and change orders are going to come out of this. But it's because you haven't really thought the robustness or something in the marketplace has changed, such that you've got to change the scope of the project. And that can have all sorts of implications in terms of delays or increased time to do the project, which has an impact on your finance drawdowns, which then has an impact on your return of investment, because clearly the project's going on longer, so getting the tenants in to return your money is going to take longer, which has an impact on all sorts of things. So it's a lot bigger than just dealing with a change order or that sort of thing. It's got bigger implications all the way down the line. So again, this comes back to the initial stages of really looking at what you want when you're putting your development together and what the marketplace wants, more importantly. You know, what are the demands? What's going to make this unique to make it rentable? What do I have to add in at the very beginning to get tenants in? I mean, we talked briefly about the changing circumstances of what's going on in the marketplace at the moment. We are hopefully getting out of the pandemic and all the madness that went with that. However, in my opinion, the workplace and people's lives has changed probably irrevocably now. as people have got used to working from home, yeah, there's strains and stresses and all that sort of thing around it. But people, you know, relish the extra time at home from having to commute. However, a lot of modern places don't have sufficient facilities for working at home. So perhaps you need to consider a home office or a little study nook or something like that, where it's more comfortable for people to work from home, even if it's going to the predicted new norm of working from home for 2 or 3 days a week and going to the office for 2 or 3 days of the week. It's going to become part and parcel of most people's lives if you are office-based. So it's understanding all of those sorts of things so you don't have to expand the envelope of the project.
Makes sense to me. And just going sort of back to what you just said, in effect, the better the briefing, the better the understanding of what's going on and what's needed in the market, then that should, if you have those two things in place, then that should help to offset some scope creep. That's what I've taken away from that in layman's terms. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Moving on to number three then, and I think people, when they hear this, are going to not cringe, but they're going to think, yeah, I'm a bit, you know, I do too much micromanaging in certain aspects. But we've put number three here, dictation of contractor. And I'm imagining that's going to be one person trying to control everything else in the project and not letting the professional teams do their job properly. Does that sound about right? And is that such a common thing to happen in projects?
To a certain extent, you're correct. Allowing one person or the entity, but it's a bit wider than that. Again, it comes back to if you've got poor specifications or loose procurement of a contractor, whether it be a tender or seeking prices or what have you. So this is moving on beyond the initial brief, but now putting contractual documentation together. And I know at the smaller end of doing property refurbishments or small-scale developments, there is a tendency to just put a rough brief together, spec and drawings and all of that sort of thing, to get a contractor on board, and may even not have a formal contract. So when you've got that looseness of contractual documentation and contractual arrangements, that's where the contractor, if you haven't got a strong project management capability, can ride roughshod over you as the client and take control and dictate the contract. It also means that they will, contractors being contractors, and, you know, again, this is not a dig at contractors, it's just life in the contracting world. They all want to make money. So they will try and get away with most minimum that they possibly can. Mm-hmm. So they'll put the basic specification in, they'll cut corners on this, or, oh, well, he probably doesn't know what's going on here, I'll put a cheaper boiler in or what have you. So again, if you haven't got all those specifications done really tightly, the contractor can take over and start dictating what's going on the project. And then once the project's finished, you're left holding the baby with a poorly completed project, not what you wanted, not the finishes you wanted, or whatever else it is. So the contractor has ended up leading the project to make more profit for himself, leaving you with additional costs or not really what you wanted out of the project.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm nodding my head furiously in agreement. So again, it will go down to the better the specification at the start, then the better the chance of things actually working smoothly. Moving on to number four, if we may, desire for an impractical design.
This is a good one. On two fronts, getting into slightly bigger projects here, but quite often a project can become a personal trophy, if you like, a statement by that person that, well, look what I've produced and all that sort of thing. So let's just take a simple office. They want this trophy building all glass and steel and looking all hunky-dory, et cetera, et cetera. But what they probably won't have done is realise the cost of running that building, either because they put a lot of glass, say, on a south-facing facade, which is going to generate huge heat gain, but they haven't put air conditioning in, or they put this flash stainless steel and glass staircase in the main entrance, which is going to take forever to keep clean and look nice. All of these sorts of flash things that they want to make it look like a trophy building, to make a statement you know, almost like leaving a legacy, or if it's your own little corporate office, making a statement about what you are as a business, whatever it is, without thinking through the practicalities of what that means, not only in the added potential cost of building that building, but also, as I say, coming back to the whole life cycle thing of how much extra cost it's going to be to run it, whether it be increased energy consumption, even if you have put air conditioning and you've got a south facade of windows, that's going to add a lot of heat gain in, which means your loading on your air conditioning is going to be higher, which means your electricity costs are going to be higher. So yes, it looks nice and flash, but it's not practical from a running point of view. And again, coming back to this common theme that's coming out here, if you haven't specified and briefed the team properly in the first place, and you're not controlling the process properly from the get-go, architects have a renown of making things impractical in their design as well. Because again, that's their game. They want their own ego to be put into that design because that's their statement of life. It's their reference point for their style of architecture going forward. But it isn't necessarily what the client really wants. And it can have an impact on the operational costs. So again, people are not thinking about the end game right at the beginning in terms of all these issues. So that's what I mean by having an impractical design. And there's also operational things. I mean, I was involved in a hospital many years ago, and we went in there as the facilities manager to pick up on this. And we said, where are all the storerooms for the linen and all the specialist equipment and all this sort of thing? Oh, we didn't think we'd need that because it's on an existing hospital site. But this hospital was a highly specialist one where their intake was at 2-3 o'clock in the morning because it was head injuries and heart attacks. So by the time they'd been through A&E and stabilized, they were coming in the middle of the night when all the stores of the main hospital were closed, wouldn't work. So again, an impractical design impacting on the operations of a facility.
Yeah, that's a bit daft from the hospital's point of view. But again, just trying to get that into my head. That's a bit strange. In terms of, so if I, again, hypothetically, I'm sat here, I've never done a commercial conversion before. And if I'm looking at an old office building and, you know, I've looked at the rough square meterage and I know that I can get, I don't know, 10 two-bedroom flats, decent sizes, let's just say they're 60 meters per dwelling. Yeah. In my head, that's what needs to be achieved. Let's just say there's market demand for two-bedroom dwellings as well. Sure. When we're talking about impracticality, for me, the way that I would look at it is that I would then need to rely on the professional team that I choose to align myself with. Is that as simple as going to an architect, for example, and saying, hey, I've got this building here, looking for 10 two-bedroom flats, and that's it? Or is that such a loose thing to say, but then without having a lot of knowledge of what exactly is needed? I'm not sure if that even makes sense, what I've just said. Is that something you're able to answer? Yeah, I mean, have that, I made sense?
Yes, you have. Yeah, I mean, that's a typical approach. Oh, I think I can get 10 flats out of this, just hand it over to the design team, and immediately you're burning money with the design team, where you probably haven't thought it through or even checked that it's viable. I'll give you two examples of a couple of conversion projects I've recently looked at for a couple of people. One was the classic office to residential conversion, where a small rectangular two-story ground and first floor office building. And the person wanted to put 3 flats per floor in and then extend it another 2 floors to end up with 12 flats in the overall building. And all I had was an external front elevation picture of the building as is. And I said, well, from what I'm seeing here, there's two things. First, the front door is right in the middle. So the chances are there's a staircase behind that, which goes right through the middle, meaning that you probably only get a flat on the left-hand side and a flat on the right-hand side, because the wraparound third flat at the back probably isn't going to be able to be done without doing a proper survey. So that immediately impacts on the financial returns, because you're not going to have the right number of flats to make that project viable from the rental implication. And then the roof was a pitched roof. So that had to be all taken off, building raised, and then all put back on again, which was a huge cost, which may have impacted on the financial viability of the project. Whereas if it had been a flat roof, you could have just quickly ripped off the floor coverings, strengthened the roof, and just carried on building, which would have been a lot cheaper. So again, it's looking right at the very beginning of any project and looking at the viability of what you're trying to achieve, which may be looking at some financial calculations on returns, albeit very crude, just to see whether this is going to work in a ballpark basis. Then, as I said before, you start to build your brief together, all before you've started to get the design team on board and incur real cost. That initial feasibility study, if you like, could be done in-house if you're reasonably competent at doing that, or with somebody that's going to be much more cost-effective in helping you do that, before you get, as I say, into the expense of getting the architects who will just run with it at any rate if you haven't got it properly specified. And then the second one I looked at was a conversion of a large B&B building into an HMO with some 12, 15 bedrooms in it. So it's a big conversion over four floors. So I immediately raised a number of questions on this in terms of, well, this is four floors. So have we got full fire protection in place? Because once you're over two stories, you've got to have full protected staircases, fully integrated alarm systems and all that sort of thing, which is quite expensive. Has that been factored in? Now, I looked at a number of the bedrooms and two or three of them were tiny. And I said, are they actually going to be viable in the marketplace? Would you be better on having a smaller number of bigger bedrooms that are going to be easily lettable or more easily lettable than trying to use the cost of maximizing the number of rooms and then not being able to let the small rooms because they're just impractical for a tenant to live in? Those sorts of things. So you've gone to the extra cost, squeezed other people's accommodation, made the whole building feel overcrowded for the sake of trying to get an extra tenant in. Whereas if you'd broken it down into smaller number of bigger bedrooms and double bedrooms, still probably have the same number of tenants in there, but your return is going to be a lot higher because you've got better income streams and less capital cost. And then I started raising, well, there's a lot of people in there. What about storage facilities? Where are people going to put this, particularly if you've got small bedrooms? Have you thought about storage? And then from my own personal experience as a landlord, particularly with the younger generation and cost of transport these days, they tend to have bicycles. And where do the bicycles end up? In the hallways, damaging the facility and all that sort of thing. So have you considered a cycle store? Simple things like that, which would A, bring you a unique selling point, but it will also save you cost going on into the operation of that HMO.
Perfect. I appreciate that insight. I would say to people, one point you just made there, Ian, that was very pertinent, was the looking at having potentially less rooms in said building in order to make the building more functional. I just want to point people back to last Monday's episode with Matt Baker, who deals with HMOs. He said the exact same thing. So, you know, good that multiple people are singing from the same hymn sheet. Swiftly moving on to number five, seven deadly sins of construction. And number five, poor schedule management. Going to sort of preempt something here. I'm going to guess that's going to come down to, is it in relation to briefings as well? If the briefing's not good and people don't know what they're doing, then this can lead to schedule management issues, or have I got the wrong end of the stick here?
Yeah, you're spot on. Again, this all comes together, this common theme of getting it right at the beginning and really going into a lot of detail and working out what you want so that when your design team puts this together, it's fully fledged. And then it's looking with a contractor at how long is this going to take. Now, if I wheel back to the very beginning, I'm a great believer in putting a load of basic stuff together at the beginning. So you do your budget and your financial model or what have you on crude costs. Does it stack in broad principles at the very beginning? If it doesn't, do a little bit more work. And if it still doesn't, then you know that you're not onto a good project or a conversion or what have you. If it does stack, then obviously you refine that and you can try and squeeze the costs whilst maintaining the quality you want or what have you to try and make it better and better as you go forward. So it's an iterative process. You also need to look at that with a timeline. and that's what we mean by schedule management, the program, the timeline, in construction parlance, the Gantt chart. So this is a chart of all the activities that have to be done, from ripping out the existing building, putting in the alterations, the structural alterations, the steelworks, the rewirings, the decorations, all of that. Each one of those takes time. And it all has to be sequenced, because you clearly can't be decorating a room if you're still knocking seven bells out of the building with walls coming down and things like that. Although I have seen that. I have seen walls painted on three walls whilst they were taking the fourth down. But hey-ho, each to their own. But you've got to schedule this out. And why this is important, A, if you don't get it right, particularly if it's started to get into a more significant project of hundreds of thousands, that then means delays and claims by the contractor, because a contractor has what's called preliminaries, which is his overhead for running the project. So the project manager, who's on a timeline, maybe site hut or temporary toilets and all of those sorts of things, which are on time-based charges. Well, he'd have priced that, say, on a 20-week project. Well, if it suddenly goes to a 30-week project, all of those things have to be extended out in cost. But more importantly, if you don't schedule out your timeline properly in the first place, that then impacts on your debt repayment. Now, you may have had a bridging loan to do the construction work on the basis that you then refinance once all the tenants are in and all the risky construction work is done. The financial institution, bank or whatever it is, will also want to look at your income streams to make sure that your overall viability works. So clearly you've got to borrow money, or you may be lucky enough to have that capital up front to do that work. Well, you initially assess that to be done in 3 months, so the bank is then being asked for repayments on month four. Well, if you've got delays because you haven't scheduled this out correctly, clearly you're not going to be able to start paying the bank back on month four, because you haven't got the income because the tenants aren't it. And that has a serious impact on your interest charges and potentially putting you in default and the bank coming in and taking back the property. Plus, if it's an extended period, again, it impacts on your viability of the project, because you've got an extended period of construction, increased interest charges on the bridging loan or the interim financing, because you've got no income. How do you pay the interest charges to start with? So often they are done on what's called a roll-up basis. So your, say, 6 months construction, the interest charges on that are added to the capital lending, so that then comes back to the bank once you've started getting tenants and cash flowing the income stream from the rent. So there are a number of implications by not getting the scheduling right all the way around, in terms of, you know, potential disputes, extra costs, delayed repayment of debt, and all sorts of things. So by not scheduling this out correctly and properly thinking it through, you can be upsetting all sorts of different parties.
As I've said a few times already in the episode, that makes perfect sense to me. So hopefully, you know, people listen as well. They take heed, even if you're an experienced developer, take heed of that. So number five, that's poor schedule management. Moving on to the last two now, the seven deadly sins of construction. You've put down number six, productivity problems. Are you able to elaborate on that, please, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, this is the classic situation of labour availability, which in the current world is something that has to be taken very seriously, because there is potentially a shortage of labour at the moment in the UK and elsewhere in the world, and or plethora of increased activity in construction works. Not the best dynamics, increased workload and shortage of labour. So that means lead times to get people on board are being extended. It also means that contractors inevitably are taking on more than they can deal with. So they haven't got the labour to deal with this. So they bring the painter in for a day, then they move it onto another site because they're trying to spin all the different plates and keep all their clients happy. But in reality, they're keeping none of their clients happy. It could be that for some reason you need a highly specialist trade to come in, and those people are not easily available. So again, this comes back to your specifications or what have you, that you need to look at things carefully at the beginning to say, am I actually getting into a situation where well, might not actually be able to do this for 6 months because the person that I need to do that particular type of work or that particular type of finish is not actually available for 6 months. And then if you are managing the project yourself rather than through a contractor or a project manager, the chances are, if you're not on that project all the time, really standing on the shoulders of people to make sure things are going on, then the productivity of those operatives is going to drift and it's going to start taking longer. You know, there's this thing, oh, I don't know how to get this priced. I'll do this on what's called a day work charge, which is the biggest way to suicide going, where you bring somebody on a day rate charge. You've not got it specified again. They're just plastering the walls. And because they're on a day charge, they've got no incentive to get the job done because they're getting paid for every hour or every day that they're working. Whereas if you've got a fixed price, they are going to be incentivized to get that done because it's their cost if they overrun it without undue issue on your side. So productivity issues come out from a whole host of different things. And bearing in mind that if you're trying to do some early stage work and you haven't got workers, or they're taking far longer than is anticipated through productivity issues or poor scheduling, you know, a lot of this all links together. That then has an impact on when the painters and decorators come in, for instance, or when the electricians could come in. And so you've delayed because of issues around the demolition and remodeling bit. The electrician can't come on board when he was allocated. He's now busy on something else. So he's now 3 months down the line before he can come back because he's now committed on another project. And then the painters, and it just all goes on. So this comes together with a whole different number of issues in terms of specifying the full workload, managing the workers on site, making sure everything's coming together, but also being aware of lead times to bringing equipment and people on board, because again, there's been material shortages and all sorts of things like that. Now, again, coming back to what I just discussed earlier, if you've bought a building and heavily invested it, particularly if you're borrowing a significant proportion of that building to buy it in the first place, and then you're borrowing money to do the refurbishment or remodeling or upgrades, and suddenly all of these things start to hit, your costs are just going to skyrocket out of control because of all these issues starting to pile up on top of each other. Now, I may sound like I'm a bit of a doom monger all of a sudden here, and people say, why on earth are we doing these projects? But it comes back to my common theme that if you thought this through at the beginning and got it right, then it all should flow a lot easier and the risk is taken out of it. Whereas if you don't think these things through and you just do it on the hoof as you're going along, which I know a lot of people try and do, that's when you're going to get the serious issues coming out.
And that's also why it's valuable to have yourself on the show as well, because, again, there's going to be a multitude of people listening to this with different experiences. Some people will have been doing various projects for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, and they might be taking, you know, a little bit of information away going, oh, I didn't know that. There'll be people like myself that, you know, might have a, you know, buy-to-let portfolio in the background, haven't necessarily started doing any development projects yet. And that's why you see me furiously making notes. So first of all, thank you for imparting your knowledge. Is it nothing wrong with sounding doom and gloom? It's about providing pragmatic and realistic information. Talking of communication and documentation, that's number seven. So again, what I'm taking away from this is with the communication part is work well with your team. And, you know, if there's no vision, no briefing about what's expected, that lack of communication can skew a project. And also with documentation, going on what you were just talking about with productivity problems as such, if the right documentation is in place and the right contracts are in place, again, that's going to help the project run more smoothly. Again, is that about right for summary?
Yeah, spot on. That's the essence of what we're trying to do here. So documentation speaks for itself. But if you've not got a documented, starting all the way at the beginning, the brief and everything else fully documented so everybody clearly understands that, or you've got a document that people can question so that you can refine it, make it better, through to the specifications of the standard of work that you're trying to achieve, and the contract documents. And again, a lot of people just do things on drawings and specs, and they don't put a contract together because they think, oh, it's only a £50,000 project, or it's only £100,000, doesn't matter. Well, if you haven't got that properly documented and put under contract, and there are simple standard forms of contract that you can do for small contracts, if you haven't got that in place, suddenly something could go wrong, then where are you? You're in dispute. On what basis are you on dispute? And again, the costs start to escalate away. So your documentation is vital. I know it's a pain in the backside having to do documentation and get it right. But if you do that, it will save your skin later on in terms of making sure you're getting what you really want out of this project. But it also starts to allow for clarity to be there. As soon as you've got clarity with your documentation and everything else, everybody starts to understand what you're trying to achieve and have got a far better opportunity and ability to deliver what you want quickly and easily. Which then links back to the whole communication piece. You know, your documentation is your base load of your communication, but then it's the ongoing dialogue and communication. And communication, like we're doing today, is a two-way street. There's no use you saying to the contractor, I need this, I need that, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. So the contractor's not coming back and saying, well, I've got a problem here, I'm delayed here, there's an issue here, how are we going to resolve this, all of that sort of thing. And again, contractors are renowned for, it'll be all right on the night, and not reporting what the true status of their situation is. And it gets to a tipping point where their delays are irrecoverable, no matter how much they work. And therefore, you need to understand that, and the contractor needs to be told that we need to know everything, bad news, good news, everything, all the way down the line. So again, that two-way flow communication is essential with the contractor, but also with the design team. If you've got architects and engineers on board, they need to be confident of giving you information of bad issues, or we've actually discovered that this beam is actually not adequate, we've got to replace it, whatever it is. You've got to have that two-way communication and then record it as well. So if you're recording it or keeping records of what's going on, then you've got a far better chance of getting through this whole maze of doing a development on the upside with everybody happy. And at the end of the day, everybody needs to be happy, and then everybody wins out of it.
And that's what it's all about, creating win-win situations at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Just a quick summary, because we're well aware that the title of the episode is "And How to Avoid the Seven Deadly Sins," which we'll touch upon in a second. But just to summarise the seven deadly sins of a construction project, number in no particular order, number one, excessive change orders, and then number two, scope creep, number three, dictation of contractor, number four, desire for an impractical design, number five, poor schedule management, number six, productivity problems, number seven, lack of communication and documentation. Ian, I know you mentioned this multiple times throughout the seven deadly sins, the ways in which to avoid these deadly sins. It all starts with that big B word, briefing. Is there anything else you would add to that on how to avoid these seven deadly sins?
In my opinion, getting that briefing, or as I call it in technical parlance, the project initiation document, or PID. So if any of your listeners are familiar with PRINCE2 project management principles, PID, or project initiation document, is something that comes up regularly. And there is a prescribed route, and I've developed my own version of that, where I've gone through with all my experience of how you go through all the different elements of putting together that initiation document. And it starts off with the vision and the purpose of the project. And you might say, why do I want a vision or a purpose of the project if I'm converting a house into an HMO? In my opinion, you still do, because what are you really trying to achieve out of this? What standard of accommodation are you trying to achieve? What are the returns that I want out of this project? You know, why am I doing this? You know, most people don't even consider that question. Why am I doing this? They just think it's a good idea. So it's putting all of that together, and then, as I say, doing things like feasibility, market awareness, financials and budgets, and then briefings and specifications and all that sort of thing. So you build up this very comprehensive document before the design team is really involved. such that you go away from that knowing that you started off on the right foot, and then maintain that all the way through with good communication and documentation.
All I can say is I'm smiling like a Cheshire cat. All I can say is a massive thank you to so much quality information to take away from this episode. If people want to reach out to you and look to potentially work with you, how can people find you?
Sure. The easiest way is to go onto my website, usual www.ianjrogers.com. So that's Ian, and then the letter J, and then Rogers, Rogers.com, all one word. And that will get you involved and enable you to connect with me the easiest and most memorable ways. I mean, I help people through training, coaching, consulting, whatever modality people think they might need help with. And I also do have a podcast called Property Done Properly, which goes along these sorts of stories. And I explore these areas in a lot more detail than we have today on a topic-by-topic basis. And as I say on my podcast, when property is done properly, everybody wins.
Couldn't agree more on that. Ian, thank you very much. Cracking stuff, as usual. We'll put links to your website podcast in the
brilliant
show notes.
Thank you
very much for your time.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks a lot. Bye, everybody.